I am very happy, very excited to be opening up God's Word to you this morning. Giving money is something that Christians are supposed to do. Generosity and the Christian faith just go hand in hand, like chips and salsa, like spaghetti and meatballs. Christians give money. And that's a good thing. It's right and it's true. I learned that valuable lesson early on when I was a boy. It was part of our Saturday night routine in the Bergstrom household, and it began right after dinner. Now, I didn't particularly like this routine one bit, but here's how it went. After dinner on Saturday night, I had to polish my shoes for church. Does anybody ever polish shoes? Okay, I had to do that. I had to lay out my Sunday outfit for the next day. I had to do my Sunday school lesson. It's another thing that's seldom not done. I had to take a bath, whether I needed it or not. And then I had to go to my drawer where I kept my earnings from my paper route and take out of that drawer the money that I was going to put in the offering plate in church the next day. I learned through forced repetition that giving money to the work of the Lord is to be the routine component of a believer. And I'm thankful for that influence. But what I didn't learn as a boy was why. Why are Christians supposed to give money? Why should we part with our hard-earned money? I think about as close as I got to a reason was we're supposed to. We're just supposed to give. And that's true, and that was a good enough reason to get me through my childhood. But as an adult, with the ever-challenging realities of raising a family, I found that, and still find, that I need more motivation than we're supposed to give. I need the support of an additional motivation to get me through those times when I'm kind of second-guessing my commitment to give. This sermon today, I believe, will provide that motivation. It'll give us all a really, really good reason to be generous. This sermon is the second sermon in our mini-series on money matters. Nate spoke last week and challenged us to be content, with what God has given us. This morning, I will ask us all to be generous. I will ask us all to be generous with our money, not because we're supposed to, but because of a very compelling reason given to us in the Bible by Jesus himself. In a parable spoken to his disciples, Jesus gives us a reason that we seldom think about. I find it powerful, and I hope you do too. And it's my goal that each of us, as a result of listening to Jesus' words, will rethink our budget and see if there isn't some way for us to be a little more generous than we are today. Now, I know this is a lofty goal. Giving is tough. It's tough for you, and it's tough for me. While Jesus may have a good reason why we should give, we have a few reasons of our own why we shouldn't. Here's one reason we struggle to give. We have pressing needs. We have pressing needs, and there's nothing left. In my lawn care business, I worked for a beautiful woman. She was 90 years old, beautiful in and out. I loved her. She was from Sweden. Her name was Gunvor, and it was shortened to Gunny. Everybody called her Gunny, and she told me a story from her childhood. She said, one day I went to my mom and said, Mom, I need new shoes. My shoes are falling apart, and they were. Her mother sympathized but said, Gunny, we have no money. I'm sorry, you'll have to wait. A couple days later, Gunny was going through or putting something in her mom's dresser drawer, and she found a jar full of money. She grabbed it, excited, ran to her mom. We do have money for my shoes. Her mom replied, no, we don't. The money in that drawer is the Lord's money. That's the money we're giving to him. It doesn't belong to us. Now, why would a mom give away money when her own daughter needs shoes? Shouldn't a good parent take care of the pressing needs first and then give what's left over? Legitimate needs like shoes and school supplies or braces or car repairs compete for our money, and it makes it difficult for us to give. Here's another reason we find giving money difficult. The amount that we give is so small compared to the need. We feel that our gift can't possibly make a difference. So why give it? Suppose a missionary needed support, but you could commit to maybe $15 a month. But his monthly budget might be $5,000 or $6,000 a month. You might reason, what's $15 toward $5,000? It's peanuts. So I give. Up down the hall in our children's church gang, we collect money week after week for Danny and Annie, our missionaries in India. Your children come with dimes and nickels, an occasional dollar, and we take it seriously. Every dime, every nickel, even every penny makes its way to India. It really does. But does that small amount actually make a difference? Sometimes we feel our gift amounts to just a drop in the bucket. So why give? We're reluctant to do that. But here's a final reason we might choose not to be generous, and probably the best, biggest obstacle of all. When we give away our money, we won't have it left to spend on ourselves. When my grandfather died, the family needed to sort through his belongings. And in the process, they came across his checkbook registers, a whole bunch of them, and they went back for years. They were an accurate record of how my grandfather spent his money. What became obvious is that my granddad was a faithful giver. He had committed to certain ministries, and week after week, year after year, he wrote checks, a lot of checks. Now, suppose my grandfather had chosen to put all that money in a 401k instead of those ministries. He would have been a wealthy man. My grandfather could have used that money. He could have bought a ranch in Texas with that money for his children to enjoy, for his grandchildren to enjoy. If he'd invested that money, I'd be out riding the range and roping longhorns right now. But instead, my grandfather lived out the last decade of his life in a small room in a retirement home, and then he willed his remaining money to yet another ministry. When we give away our money, we're giving up things that we would very much like to have, and that makes it tough for us to be generous. When it comes to being generous with our money, we're in a tug of war. There are reasons to keep it pulling hard on one side, and there are reasons to give it away pulling hard on the other. And there are, in fact, strong reasons to keep it, as we have seen. This morning, we're going to see if Jesus can give us one stronger reason to give it away. So open your Bibles, please, to Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 9. Luke 16, 1 through 9. On Wednesday night this week, I read this parable of Jesus to Les. I said, I'm going to preach on this on Sunday. She listened to it, and then she said, that story makes no sense. You need to pick a different passage. Now, I admit, this is one crazy story. It really is, but I believe it makes a very significant point. Hopefully, when I'm done, you don't whisper to the person next to you, Leslie was right. He should have picked a different passage. It's a parable. A parable is a colorful story that makes a single point. Here's the plan. We're going to spend the overwhelming majority of our time just enjoying this story. We're going to walk through this story. And then with the time that's remaining, we're going to deal with that point. The parables 1 through 8, we're going to spend a lot of time there. The point is verse 9. We'll comment on that. So here we go. Why should you and I be generous with our money? You ready? Verse 1 and 2. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot manage any longer. Jesus told a story here that would have been very familiar to his listeners. It was common in that day for a wealthy man to hire somebody to oversee his estate. This manager here would be given wide authority to handle and oversee the many arms of his master's financial interests. Now, some of you here might have a financial advisor, somebody that makes suggestions what to do with your money moving forward. That's not what Jesus is talking about. This is way more than somebody giving advice. This guy writes checks. He pays bills. He hires. He fires. He lends out. He collects. A good manager would be very, very helpful for a wealthy man. The success of an arrangement like that depends on one thing, trust. The master needs to have total trust in his manager's competence, but by far most important, he needs to trust in the guy's integrity. Toward the end of my illustrious 25-year career in the lawn care business, I grew profoundly weary of handling the finances. I couldn't stand it any longer. So I entrusted the checkbook and every single detail of the office work to my coworker. From time to time, he would hand me the checkbook, and I would literally sign 30, maybe 40 blank checks and hand him back the checkbook for him to pay the bills, to manage the receivables. He did everything for me, and he was a true blessing because he was entirely trustworthy and his integrity was beyond question. It worked. But in this story here, that was not the case. This guy was a scoundrel. We read that he wasted his manager's possessions. That word wasted, Jesus borrowed that word from a previous story he told about the prodigal son. Remember that guy? He squandered his father's wealth in wild living. It's the same word. He squandered it. This guy squandered his master's money. This manager wasn't guilty of just making a few careless mistakes. No, no. He took advantage of his master. He abused his manager. He selfishly hurt the guy. Who knows? Maybe he padded his expense account and got a few NFL tickets or something like that. Or maybe he upgraded his company donkey to a Dodge Ram 3500 4x4 or something like that. Or maybe he just simply embezzled funds directly. Maybe he found a way to siphon off his master's money into his own account. Whatever he did to squander his master's possessions, it was over. He had his hand in the cookie jar and he got caught, and the master slammed down the lid. He said, "You cannot be my manager any longer." This wasn't like disciplinary action. They didn't send him off for peer review. They didn't say, "You need to go see human resource department." No, this was it. He was canned. He was fired. Now, some of you here, I suspect, have lost a job suddenly without warning. Maybe your company had to downsize quickly and you're out. Now, it's one thing to know in advance to be able to prepare, but it's another thing just like to walk into your office on a Tuesday morning and say hi to your coworkers, get your coffee, boot up your computer, and then see a pink slip sitting on the desk. That's heart-stopping. I had a friend who was also in the lawn care business. His business was similar to mine, but the bulk of his business was in one large commercial account. One ordinary day, he was getting ready for work. He was loading up his machinery. He was getting ready to pick up his guys, and he noticed a fax at the machine. So he just casually picked it up and read the fax. The fax said this: "We no longer need your services, effective immediately." It was from that large commercial account. He had a wife. He had kids. He had a car. And he had no business to support it. That was a devastating punch in the gut. And that's what happened here. That's what happened here. You cannot manage any longer, period. The goose that had been laying the golden eggs was now dead. And this guy was in a tight spot. So immediately his mind starts racing. What on earth am I going to do? He says, the manager said to himself, "What shall I do now?" In verse 3, "My master's taken away my job." So he starts brainstorming his options. What am I going to do? Now, he didn't consider getting another white-collar job, maybe managing for someone else. He figured probably wouldn't get a favorable review from my former employee or employer. So he considered manual labor. He's thinking, "Well, I can dig ditches. They don't do background checks, no drug tests. They'll hire anybody." But he quickly dismissed that idea. We read in verse 3, he says, "I'm not strong enough to dig." That's not an option. So he ended up thinking about the bottom rung option, his last choice. He said, "I can beg. I'm going to find some busy intersection with a lot of traffic. I'm going to put on some shabby clothes. I'm going to hold up a sign that says, out of work, hungry," conveniently leaving off that part about embezzling. But that plan wasn't very appealing to him either. We read, he says, "I'm ashamed to beg." So he's out of options. I picture this guy sitting in a coffee shop. He's made a list on paper of all his bills, and when it's all going to hit the fan, he's thinking, 60 days, I'll lose my cell phone. I'll be evicted by June. I've got enough food in the refrigerator to last maybe till Friday. I can hang out at my sister's house, sleep on her couch for maybe 2 weeks. I'm doomed. Put his head in his hands, elbows on the head, on the table. He's just shaking his head. What am I going to do? And an idea popped into his mind. An awful idea. A wonderfully awful idea. He's thinking, this might just work. He recalled his master's words. The guy said, give an account of your management, because you can no longer be my manager any longer. The master was saying, bring in the books and the ledgers, and then the axe would fall completely. He realized that he wasn't technically, formally, entirely terminated. Not yet. Until he gave an account to his boss, he still had a tiny little window to turn things around. He still had the ledger books. He still had authority to write checks. He still had financial influence. And if he was lucky, he still had just enough time to profoundly alter his future. He says in verse 4, he says, I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. What an idea. He says, I'm not going to starve. I'm going to thrive. If I can pull this off, people are going to buy me coffee. They're going to take me out for dinner. They're going to invite me over for picnics. They're going to even give me a place to stay in their house. But I've got to act quickly. I don't have much time. So he put it into high gear and began to carry out his dirty, rotten little scheme. He first needed to get all his master's debtors, everybody that owed his master's money, need to get them together. We read in verse 5. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. You and I tend to dismiss promises that come our way in the mail. Like, you know, Mr. Bergstrom, you want a cruise to Hawaii. Or somebody says, oh, yeah, right, I did. Or they say, you know, come by and pick up a flat screen TV. It's yours. Just stop by and get it. I don't think so. It's probably a refrigerator magnet or something like that. But imagine a different type of appeal that might get your attention. What if you got in the mail or maybe an email from the CFO of Rusty Wallace Honda, the guy himself, place where you bought your car, and the email said something like, stop by today. I want to make you a financial proposition. I'm going to save you bundles. I'm not going to sell you a thing, I promise. Stop by tomorrow between 3 and 4. Now, you'd be suspicious, but you'd also be intrigued, maybe even intrigued enough to stop by his office between 3 and 4 the next day. And that's what happened here. However this guy did it, it says each one of his master's debtors, they showed up in his office, curious, suspicious. They're thinking, what's going on here? What's the deal? And he continues to work his plan. Let's read what he does. Beginning in verse 5, picture a lobby full of these debtors and deals with number one. He said he called in each of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 400. Then he asked the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. Oh, my goodness. It could have happened something like this. Lobby's full of people. Calls in Mr. Jones first. Mr. Jones, I see you've been a faithful customer of my master for many, many years. I just want to thank you by taking a look at your bill. You've been faithful with your payments every month. We appreciate that here at our company. And I also heard that your wife's pregnant. You're going to have another baby. The expenses might be a little tight. 800 gallons. Let's make that 400 gallons. Would that help you out a bit? Just sign here quickly. Scribble out 800. Change it to 400. I just need your signature. Mr. Jones staggers out of the office, stunned. It's like, I don't believe it. The guy just cut my bill in half. What a great guy. That'd be like Rusty Wallace, CFO, taking 15 grand off your $30,000 car note. On to the next guy. Mr. Smith walks in. Mr. Smith, I hear you owe 1,000 bushels a wheat. That's quite a debt load. Understand your son's going to go into A&M this fall. It's a great school, but, you know, a little pricey. What do you say I lowered your debt to maybe 800 or so? Just sign here quickly. And on your way out, send in the next guy. And on one by one, all through the afternoon, he's doing business, handshakes, hugs, high fives, discounting everybody's bill. By the end of that day, he'd made a whole lot of new friends. His Facebook likes soared. You better believe that Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith and all those other guys would be eager to return the favor in any way they could. This guy, in one afternoon, became the most beloved man in town. His plan worked, but he still had one tiny thing to tie up, one loose end. Somehow, he needed to survive the meeting with his master. Yikes. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine being in his shoes at that moment? He has just, in essence, robbed his master of thousands and thousands of dollars after having already squandered his possessions. It's going to be an uncomfortable conversation. Now, we've all had uncomfortable conversations. Maybe a teenager, you know, you just got your license. You had to come home and say, Dad, I wrecked the car. That's an uncomfortable conversation. Or one of you guys, you know, honey, I accidentally threw that wool sweater in the dryer with my work clothes for 4 hours on high. You know, it looks like it shrunk a little bit. Uncomfortable conversations. And that's what's about to happen here. This manager is about to hand over the ledger books with all those debts changed. He's thinking, will I be stabbed? Will I be shot? Will the guy arrest me and have me flogged? What will the master do to me? The time came for the meeting. The manager sat down, gulped, slid the books across the table. The master picked them up, began to look at the numbers one by one, and he begins to see exactly what this guy had done. In silence, he took it all in. And he closed the books, he looked the manager in the eye, and he spoke quietly these words, I commend you. I commend you. That's what we read. The master commended the dishonest servant. This is the part where Leslie said, this story makes no sense. For what on earth would this guy be commended? I mean, his dishonesty, selfish, no, lack of respect, no. For what is he commended? Since the master commended the dishonest servant, here it is, because he had acted shrewdly. Because he had acted shrewdly. The master, after he saw fully what the manager had done, said, man, I've got to hand it to you. That was clever. Some of you remember the name Frank Abagnale. He was one of the most notorious imposters of all time. The guy had up to 8 different aliases. One of them was that he posed as the chief resident pediatrician at a hospital in Georgia for about a year. The guy hadn't even gone to college. He don't know a thing about medicine. But he pulled it off. He worked for Pan Am as an airplane pilot. He didn't know how to fly a plane. At one point, I read that he actually had the controls in his hand at 30,000 feet for a brief period of time. But as he kind of deadheaded along the flights, he traveled over 1,000,000 miles. He saw 26 countries on Pan Am's dime. He posed as a lawyer and conducted business as a lawyer. He wasn't a lawyer. He posed as a sociology professor at a university. Oh, my goodness. No telling how many people Frank Abagnale hurt. And no telling how many taxpayer dollars it took to bring him to justice. But you got to admit, he was one clever dude. And so it is here. This manager did not do one morally good thing in this story. Yet, he is commended for his shrewdness, his cleverness, his strategic use of his financial influence. All right, that's the story. That's an excellent story. Jesus told an excellent story, and he told it to make a point. Jesus wants you and I to learn a very good lesson from a very bad man. So ending his story, he turns to his disciples and he tells them and us what we're supposed to learn. We read. Verse 8, about halfway down, he says, "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light." And here's the crux of the matter. "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Let me read that again. "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Is it all cleared up for you? Make perfect sense? All right, what is Jesus driving at? I mean, what is this lesson we're supposed to learn from this scoundrel? All right, let me see if I can help. This manager seized the moment in order to profoundly alter his future. Let me say that again. This manager seized the moment in order to profoundly alter his future. The lesson is we should too. This guy used his financial influence in the brief time he had left to improve his future. And like him, we should use the brief time we have left to improve our future. Not our short-term future, but our eternal future. All right, if I have to boil it all down to one statement, this is what Jesus wants us to learn. We're to use our money on earth to prepare for our eternity in heaven. You and I are to use our money on earth to prepare for our eternity in heaven. Rather than sitting around waiting for heaven, Jesus is screaming, prepare for it. Prepare for it immediately while there is still time. Now, those words, prepare for heaven, may sound strange to you. You may be thinking, Steve, don't all believers go to heaven? Yes, yes, emphatically yes. But what Jesus is saying, that not all believers will have the same rewards in heaven, not the same experience in heaven. Heaven is not one size fits all. Throughout the New Testament, we read about degrees of reward in heaven. Our degree of reward in heaven is determined by how we live our lives before we get there. Another word that Jesus spoke related to this from Matthew chapter 6. Jesus says it this way. He says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. He's saying, use your money now for your eternal future. It's not just Jesus. Paul says the same thing. Paul says in 1 Timothy, command them to be generous and willing to share. That's share your money. Why? In this way, they will lay up for themselves treasures as a firm foundation for the coming age. Those verses, this parable all points to this. Rich reward awaits believers who use their money generously. That's why we should give. Randy Alcorn coined the phrase, he says, we can't take it with us, but we can send it on ahead. At our preaching team meeting, five guys stared at verse 9, scratched our heads. What in the world does Jesus mean exactly by friends welcoming us into eternal dwellings? Friends welcoming us in eternal. Now, we knew that Jesus is talking about eternal reward, degrees of reward. It's going to be better in that day. But friends welcoming that us, what does that mean? That's puzzling. But here's a thought. What if Jesus actually meant what he said? What if his words are not cryptic? They're not allegorical. What if they are to be taken basically straightforward? What if part of our reward in heaven is literally meeting those people whose lives we have touched through our generosity? Wow, what if our reward is being greeted at heaven's gates by the people, by the friends who were blessed through our generosity. Wouldn't that be something? At DFW Airport, there's an area where people go to pick up their luggage after they've gotten off the plane. Maybe you've been there. It's at times just mobbed. You get these big carousels with hundreds of pieces of luggage just droning around and around, and thousands of people trying to get their bags, and they're craning their necks to see their brother or their friend, their ride to get home. It's not uncommon in that scene. I've been there. I've seen people holding up a piece of cardboard with someone's name on it, you know, mom or whoever, to get their attention, to connect with the person that just arrived in Dallas. All right. I picture that scene when I read verse 9. I picture that's what it's like to be welcomed by friends into eternal dwellings. Picture yourself in that scene. Picture yourself in heaven after your race on earth is won. You arrive amidst a sea of people and you see someone holding up a cardboard sign with your name on it. You make your way through the crowd to that person and you see it's not just one man, it's a whole bunch of people gathered around, and they're all smiling at you. You're thinking, who are all these people? They don't look familiar to me. A dark-skinned woman makes her way through the group and looks at you with a big smile. She says, I'm from Sudan. As a little girl, I received a shoebox at Christmas time. And in that box, there's a little tract about Jesus. I learned about Jesus from that box. I believe you were the person that sent that to me. Just wanted to say thanks. A young man in the group makes his way through the crowd. He said, you may not remember me. I sure remember you. I'm that junior high kid from Center Point Church. I couldn't afford to go on that camp out, but I was told that you paid my way. I got saved at that camp out. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. And on they go, a man with his wife and kids. He said, we got to read the Bible in our own language. We're from Peru. We didn't have it until this guy, Jim Roden, put a lot of time into it. You guys supported that missionary, didn't you? Thank you. Thank you. They keep on coming one after another. That'd be overwhelming. An orphan girl that you supported through World Vision. She said, you have no idea how you've blessed me. I've been waiting for so long to meet you. A neighbor you help with an electric bill, a bunch of kids from Awana Club and Kids Beach Club, a beautiful girl. She says, I was rescued from the crisis pregnancy at the crisis pregnancy center. All those people, through your generosity, all smiling, looking at you, all thanking you. But as they parade on by, you notice someone else standing in the background, off in the distance. It's Jesus himself taking it all in. He's also smiling, and he catches your eye, and he mouths these words, I commend you. I commend you. Now, I don't know for sure if that's what awaits us, but I do know this. When we get to heaven and get to see the fruit of our labor, we won't regret for one minute the money that we gave away in our time on earth. We won't be wishing we bought more shoes. We won't even be wishing for that ranch in Texas. We wouldn't trade that experience with all those people for a house full of shoes or for a herd of longhorns. Why should you and I give our money? Because we're supposed to? No, no. We should give our money because we have a limited, golden opportunity to profoundly impact our future. I tell you, Jesus says, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Let's take Jesus at his word and let's be generous with our money. Let's pray. Lord, give us the courage to live by faith. We pray this for Jesus' sake, for the sake of the kingdom. Amen.